Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. And on this Tuesday, 4 weeks from a consequential election day, we're launching a new series we're calling This American Moment. We're talking with writers and scientists, artists, activists, and religious leaders about the long view, where we find ourselves in this moment of American life and what it says about who we are. We're also asking our guests to reflect on how they maintain a sense of clarity in a world that feels pretty chaotic and disordered. We're opening the series with Carol Anderson. She's a scholar, political scientist, and chair of African American Studies at Emory University in Atlanta. Her new book is an investigation of voting laws and disenfranchisement for voters of color in America, and she examines a history that goes back to the years after the Civil War. But her book also concludes with examples, including here in Minnesota, of efforts to remove impediments to the ballot box. And perhaps that's where she finds some hope and clarity on the road ahead. Carol Anderson's new book is titled One Person, No Vote, and she joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia. Carol, welcome back to the show, and I'm really grateful that you're inaugurating our new series, so thank you for that as well.
Oh, and thank you for having me.
In a larger, more philosophical sense, does this moment in American life feel precarious to you? Does it feel in any way hopeful for you? Take a step back and tell me how you'd perceive that.
It feels like we can go one or two ways, where we can go the road less traveled, or whether we can fall into the abyss. That's what it feels like right now. It feels like the kind of chaos before the Civil War. It feels like the chaos, the intensity of rights violations during the Civil Rights Movement. It feels like the last gasp of white supremacy trying to strangle liberty and democracy out of the United States of America.
Is there a sense, though, with all of that urgency and all of the precariousness of what you've just described, that people are engaged?
Yes, and that really is truly where the hope is. And it's the kind of engagement where, and I would say that for many years, I would say that many Americans have been rather complacent about democracy, mm-hmm. just because things just worked. It appeared to work. And so folks just went on about their lives and they, Washington, the Capitol. And then it became very clear that everything that they held dear was under assault. We saw that, the person who currently occupies the White House did not win the majority of votes in the United States. We saw that the people then spoke back to that. We saw how the people spoke back to Charlottesville, how they spoke back to the Muslim ban. We're seeing it in terms of higher voter turnouts in the primaries, which had usually been rather, very low because people just figured, it's working, they're going to do. But no, people understand more the power of their vote.
And so what I hear and what you're describing is in this moment that feels very tumultuous— and chaotic, as I said, which is kind of the impetus for the series. How do we get some clarity in the midst of the tumultuousness? People are also Americans are trying to figure out who we see ourselves as, how we see ourselves in one another, too, mm-hmm. right? Isn't that, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. what drives this polarization, right? Like, I don't agree with your political views, and so I think I know everything there is to know about your character and you as a person, and I don't like what that reflects. And I think that's going on both sides of the political debate. How do you see it?
And so I see it more as we have more in common than separates us, but that there are vested interests who gain advantage from the polarization. And I think back to Norm Ornstein's and Thomas Mann's book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, where they talk about the shift in the Republican Party that moved it from being a party that was trying to govern. And so it realized that it had its own agenda, but that there was the need to compromise so that the nation could continue to function, continue to move forward. And then in the mid-90s, Newt Gingrich, who was a representative out of Georgia, recognized that demographically the Republican Party was going to have difficulty winning elections because their policies had moved too far to the right and the demographics of the nation were changing. And he helped spur this movement to vilify and demonize Washington and government, to demonize the opponents so that they were clearly the opponents and not somebody that you worked with as you had these differing views. And that process and so that's why I don't do both sides-ism. Because the consistent rule breaking, the consistent demonization has been hurled down and politicized and weaponized, frankly, by the Republicans. We have somebody in the White House who questioned the legitimacy, the American citizenship of Barack Obama with that birther nonsense. And you didn't find the party saying, what are you doing? But instead, they rode in on that, too. The so-called mainstream Republicans were also partaking in birtherism. That kind of demonization has poisoned the waters. And so it makes it difficult then for people to see that what we're talking about and why I say we have more in common than we have that separates us is people want decent schools. They want living wage jobs. Mm-hmm. They want access to quality health care. They want to be able to raise their families in safe neighborhoods. None of this is partisan. It's basic.
One of the things that I think flows from what you've just described about the demonization of individual politicians and the demonization of government is an unprecedented distrust by Americans in government. I mean, the numbers are startling. You know, Pew mm-hmm. Research has been polling on this for 60 years, asking Americans to assess their trust that Washington will do the right thing. The last time they asked, the number came in at 18%. I mean, you cannot deny that kind of lack of trust in Washington has an effect on a democracy, right? What do you think the effect is?
Oh, the effect is that one of the effects is that you get people opting out of the system. believing that it is impossible for government to solve anything. And again, this was a deliberate strategy. We have to understand that. And remember, government was the one that stepped in. And this is where the historical perspective is so important. It was government that stepped in during the Great Depression and said, we have to put a safety net under people. We have to get people back to work. Individual businesses could not do that. It was government that did that. It was government that figured out how to create the highway system that linked cities and towns together. That was government. It was government that provided the funding for the incredible growth of higher education in the United States. That was government that did that. And so this distrust of government to be able to handle these kinds of major issues that only something as big as government can handle has led to a stagnation. It has led to a crisis, and it has led to people opting out, believing, being demoralized, believing that their vote doesn't matter, believing that the system is rigged and that they do not have a voice.
I have to say the number that you write about with unregistered voters in America, and again, this is what flows out of, I don't trust government. Government is often demonized. Why should I participate? You say there are so many unregistered voters in America, they could populate America's 100 largest cities. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
That is,
you know, so we're talking New York City, L.A., Philadelphia, all the way to Birmingham.
What? I hear that. I hear that in your sigh. Why?
And when the constant message that you get is that government doesn't work and that it doesn't matter what you do. What happens to a democracy is that when we have that number of people who have opted out, then it means that only a small number, those who are politically engaged, those who see that, the power that government can wield, then they are the ones making the decisions. They are the ones putting people in positions of power to craft the policies. They are the ones then that those politicians and policymakers are responsive to. So we end up with a vicious, self-fulfilling prophecy that the more and more skewed the electorate becomes, the more and more those policies are only reflective of the needs of that smaller electorate.
But this is why you're suggesting that there is a vicious circular consequence of this, because the less you participate, the more you'll be ignored, and the more you'll be ignored, the less you'll participate. Right? It's driving out people who are, I guess I think of them as kind of on the fence. Should I be involved in this? Give me a, maybe they're the people who say, give me a good reason, a better reason than just everybody, every American citizen ought to vote.
Right. And so one of the things, if we were on video, you would just see me nodding my head as you were talking, because this is what happens in that skewing. And it's like, give me a reason. So I will go to when I talked in the book about the resistance in Alabama. One of the things that they did in Alabama is as they're talking to people who had been just pounded on by the state in terms of massive voter suppression. And so people are the activists are talking to people in the community going, Yeah, so what do you care about? And people would start talking about, well, I care about schools. I want my kids to be in good schools. And, you know, I want to be able to get to the doctor or and not have to choose between, you know, going to the doctor or going bankrupt. I want to be able to have clean water. I mean, as people are talking about the things that are important to them, then it becomes really clear the way that those things that are important to the way that people live their lives, the quality of their lives, is absolutely embedded in the policies that emanate out of these governmental institutions. And it's from that moment, understanding how the quality of your life is set by the frameworks, the legal frameworks, the political frameworks that are put in place, then you begin to understand why vote, why vote.
It's such a challenge, though, I think, today mm-hmm. to make mm-hmm. that connection, right? Because Washington feels so disconnected from your everyday life in a city in Texas or a small town in Alabama or, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I
know, or Atlanta. People feel like they have the luxury, voters feel like they have the luxury to say, I'm sitting it out and it won't matter. What I hear you saying is it matters in so many ways that you haven't even accounted for.
Exactly. And it matters as well that we're not just talking about Washington. We're talking about who your governor is, who your secretary of state is, who sets up the election frameworks. It matters in terms of who your mayor is, city council person, who's on your zoning board, who's on your school board. All of those things matter to the quality of the functioning of the administration, so that you can live your life to the fullest. When those things go off the rails, when a system is, for instance, replete with corruption, then things aren't happening in your community that should be happening. There's dereliction of duty, when people who aren't competent are at the helm, then things that should be taken care of routinely are not. And we feel that most urgently in the moment of a crisis, say a hurricane or a tornado or massive flooding. And so those things matter in your community as well as what's happening in your state, as well as what's happening in Washington.
Carol Anderson is inaugurating a new election season series today, every Tuesday through the end of November. We're going to be talking with guests to reflect on this American moment. It's an idea to bring big thinkers, writers and scientists, artists, activists, religious leaders, scholars to this conversation, to talk to them about the long view and the now. Where we find ourselves in this moment of American life, what it says about who we are. And I'm also asking our guests to reflect on how they maintain a sense of clarity in a world that feels really noisy and chaotic and disordered. So you will hear some kinds of questions that go to that as well in this series. Carol is a political scientist and chair of African American Studies at Emory University in Atlanta. And her new book is called One Person, No Vote. Carol, I want to talk about gerrymandering and how that feeds what we've just been discussing, which is this sense of my vote doesn't matter. My participation doesn't matter. The Supreme Court last summer sent this key Wisconsin gerrymandering case back to the lower courts. It's one that we're familiar with in this part of the country.
Right.
You write that gerrymandering has a, quote, pernicious, corrosive effect on democracy. Give me some context on that. Why?
And so what gerrymandering does is that it allows the politicians to choose who their voters will be instead of the voters choosing who their representatives will be. And it does that by skewing the lines where districts are, how district lines are drawn. And you get this undermining of the basic concept of one person, one vote. So that you have disproportionate numbers of people, say, in a city who have, you know, a city with 5 million who maybe have one or two representatives. And then you'll have this massive land mass that is sparsely populated outside the city. But there are multiple districts there. So you get this representative imbalance. That way. And what also happens is that the drawing of these districts begins to eliminate competitive races. And so it's always going to be the same person. And so it doesn't make any difference if I vote or not, because so-and-so's been there since 1990.
Right.
And so it just feels like it demoralizes the electorate. It makes people believe that their votes don't count. And what happens, for instance, with gerrymandering in Washington, D.C., is that the way that our system has been gerrymandered, we have 16 to 26 additional Republican representatives in the U.S. Congress than would normally be there if the district lines had been drawn in a non-extreme partisan way. What that also does is it has created these districts where people are safe, where the politicians are safe from the will of the voters. So this is why you see these massive disparities between the polls talking about what people want and the kinds of policies that you see emanating out of Washington. For instance, as the Republican majority was trying to gut the Affordable Care Act, you had 70% of the American population talking about they wanted that act strengthened, not gutted. But the politicians were moving forward in trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, not strengthen it. How do you explain that? Or how you had about 20% of the American population was for the tax bill that went through that provided $1.5 trillion of benefits, just raiding the U.S. Treasury, the kitty, for the uber wealthy. Only 20% of the American population thought that was a good idea and that maybe trickle down would work. It hasn't. It doesn't. But you saw that tax bill sailed through. So how is it that you have 80% who are against it, but the bill sails through?
You know, when
gerrymandering.
When I think of this issue and I connect it to a specific issue and debate in Washington, I think about Medicare negotiating on drug prices. Is there a clearer indication of the connection between I'm safe in my seat, I'm safe enough to ignore a lot of what my voters and voters at large in America say about this issue, to accept, you know, the approval and the money of the big pharmaceutical companies? So for me, that issue really says disconnected from what American voters want and safe to let it be the way it has been for so many years.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. And again, this gets to the way that we live our lives. And so while this may seem, you know, distant and remote, you think about what access to life-saving, life-sustaining, quality-of-life drugs means and what that means as well for your ability to afford other things besides drugs to keep you alive. You think about what that means in terms of the Health Care Act, the Affordable Care Act. What does it mean when they're now trying to get rid of pre-existing conditions? And 130 million Americans have a pre-existing condition. So do we go back to that place where if you've had a baby or if you have high blood pressure or if you have fought cancer and won, that you no longer have access to insurance? I mean, this is hitting home where we live. Our votes matter. They matter. And when politicians are trying to rig the system to make our votes not matter, we have to stand up and vote those folks out and make sure that we're sending the signal that there are consequences for trying to undermine our democracy and undermine citizens' right to vote.
And that is going to require the participation of these millions of unregistered voters that we talked about. Let me ask you a question, Carol, about this. What do you think comes first? Does voter apathy lead to the majority party? And I'm going to say, hey, you know that just as Republicans are good at gerrymandering, so are the Democrats. It's like the party in power uses that tool. But here's the question. It's like that chicken and egg thing. Does voter apathy lead to the majority party's ability to use gerrymandering as a tool? Or does gerrymandering instill voter apathy? And how do we break the cycle?
That's a great question. I think that what happens is that the quest for power leads politicians to figure out ways how to stay in power. And then they figure out that voter apathy is the way to do that. And they figure out that voter suppression, so those who aren't apathetic and are trying to vote, to keep them out as well. And I think that it has become even more pernicious given the high-powered mapping software, district mapping software that is now in use, blended with the kind of, I would say, Cambridge Analytic data about the proclivities of who people are and where they live so that the maps can become very exact. That to me is where it is. I think that when people are engaged, people are engaged. In our history, for instance, in the South, after the Civil War and after the 15th Amendment, there was almost an 80%, or something like 79 point something percent, of voter registration in the South.
Wow.
And then in 1890, with the Mississippi Plan, as Mississippi was trying to figure out how do we disfranchise all of these black voters, they were taking out white voters too. And it got to the point where in Mississippi, after a few years of the Mississippi Plan, which had a whole array of disfranchising tools, poll tax, literacy test, good character clause, understanding clause, white primaries, those sorts of things, that the voter turnout, I believe, had gone down. The voter registration had gone down to like 15%. So we're seeing that folks who have this quest for power, and it's all about the power, are the people who should not be in power because they do damage to democracy.
Carol Anderson with us as we begin a new series called This American Moment. She is a scholar, a political scientist, and author of the new book, One Person, No Vote. Carol, while we were talking, Darren called and mentioned that you and I had been talking about this number of unregistered voters who don't participate. And Darren says, I think a lot of that stems from a lack of emphasis on civic engagement in schools. We don't do a good job of teaching kids that it's a priority. What do you think?
I think that it's been a long time since I've been in school. but I think that part of it is that we get a very kind of flattened narrative in terms of American history and civic engagement, that this kind of progress. There were the founding fathers, and they created this fabulous constitution. And then, ooh, there was a civil war. the North won. Yay! And then, you know, there was this thing called World War I. I don't know what that was. But then there was like a Great Depression. World War II. Yay! We beat the Nazis.
There's a lot of skipping over of important history, I think I hear you saying.
Right.
And so what it means.
It means. And so it just feels like there's this kind of glide through, and that it just happens. And that, to me, that builds in a kind of complacency that democracy just works, and that you just have a few people who are, you know, making decisions and not making decisions, and boom, wow. And so we miss what that full engagement looks like, and we miss the battles over the right to vote and engagement. And when we have the opportunity, so for instance, in North Carolina, before 2010, in North Carolina had high schoolers, 16 and 17-year-olds, I believe, or 17-year-olds, pre-registered to vote. So this becomes part of that civic education.
Boy, that's great.
So, yeah. Well, when the Republicans took over, they didn't want those young folks voting. And so they eliminated in their modified voter registration piece, this voter suppression piece, where they did the voter ID, where they did the gerrymandering, where they did the closing of the polls, where they did the constriction of the early voting hours. They also eliminated pre-registration for 17-year-olds.
So this,
yeah, I know, but on the flip side of it, California, that has a very low voter turnout rate, like 42%, I believe, its Secretary of State was dissatisfied with that and said, we have got to do better, and looked at what Oregon did with automatic voter registration and said, aha. And with automatic voter registration, Oregon, which is one of the highest, not as high as Minnesota.
That's right.
That's right.
Take pride in that.
I'm telling you, I was like, yay. with voter turnout rate, when Oregon implemented automatic voter registration, their voter turnout rate increased, actually, as well as the diversity of their electorate increased. And so California looked at that and said, we're going to go you one better. And California pre-registers 16 and 17-year-olds to vote. And that has begun to look like a swell, this massive, wonderful, beautiful, democratic swell in the electorate. You know, and it's not like they're saying only Democrats or only Republicans. They're like, we want people to vote. That's how we have this democracy. And so by including 16 and 17-year-olds, that is part of that civic engagement. It gets people understanding that you have the right to vote. When you exercise that power, wow, we have a very different kind of America. We have an America that, for instance, begins to deal with the issues of student loans. Wow.
Kirsten in Lakeville called Carol to say she thinks one of the reasons that voters aren't more keen on participating is that you have no control over what happens after the election. There isn't accountability for those elected officials until the next time they're up for election. I hear the heart of that frustration from Kirsten says, we get a limited choice. It's shaped by gerrymandering and a lot of other forces that we feel like we can't control. We elect somebody, they go to Washington or they go to the state capitol, and then they're open to all of the interests, you know, some of which Kirsten might agree with, right? There is no accountability. What would you say about that?
But there is accountability. And, you know, and this is one of the things that I've seen really come to the fore since the 2016 election. congressmen and women and senators would hold these town halls, and like the regular five people would show up. But, ooh, remember when Congress was going after the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, yes.
Then all of a sudden, those town halls are packed. People are calling into their representatives' offices, laying out what the consequences will be for not adhering to ensuring the well-being of their constituents. And you saw Congressman all of a sudden going, well, you know, I don't think I'm going to be having a town hall. well, you know, that kind of civic engagement, because part of what we have to understand that our engagement does not stop when we cast a ballot. That's when our engagement begins. Mm-hmm. Actually, our engagement begins before then. But it's like we think that once we vote, then we're done until the next election.
Good point.
And it's this moment in between where, yes, they may be hearing from the lobbyist, but they're also hearing from us. And that is where we will make the difference.
One of the guests in the series is Anne Lamott, and she's out with a new book about hope. And I wonder if this sentence from the prelude, what she calls the prelude of the book, resonates with you, given the research that you do and how involved you are in our political landscape as a scholar. She says, "I am stockpiling antibiotics for the apocalypse, even as I await the blossoming of paper whites on the windowsill."
Mm.
Yeah. What does that say to you?
Prepare for the worst and fight for the best. And that really is it. I mean, when you think about it, and so I know one of the things that you have mentioned in our conversation is, how do I find hope?
Right.
How do I sustain this?
Right.
And as a historian, it is that I know that people refuse to be subjugated. And yes, there is oppression. And yes, it feels pervasive. But what history shows us is that serfdom ended in Russia. Slavery ended in the United States. And think about it. This was a system that accounted for 80% of the nation's wealth. And it ended because people fought. People who seemed to be powerless fought. People of conscience fought. I teach a class called War Crimes and Genocide. I mean, you want to talk about looking into the abyss.
Oh, yeah.
But I think about E.D. Morel, who was a shipping clerk in Belgium, and he recognized that his king, King Leopold, who had won all of these humanitarian anti-slavery awards for his work in the Congo, was in fact enslaving the Congolese, that it was all a lie. And he refused to be a part of it. Not only did he refuse to be a part of it, he was determined to stop the king from doing this, from killing, from enslaving, from stripping Congo bare. He stood up and said, "Not on my watch." That's some serious, serious power. I think about during the My Lai massacre in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
There was an American soldier who recognized what was going on, and he ordered his helicopter to be put down in between the American forces and the Vietnamese who were in the ditch getting ready to be slaughtered. And he ordered his men to train their machine guns on American forces if they dared advance on the Vietnamese. Because he said, "We are not Nazis. not on my watch. That's where my hope is that there is a strong sense of humanity in people, a strong sense that even when it looks like society is moving to the darkness, to the most base, the most vile, the most depraved state, where greed and rapaciousness seem to be the only values, that there are people who say, we're not living like that. There is a better way. And we're going to fight for that way. And we're going to fight for humanity. That's where my hope is, because history has shown repeatedly that that in those fights is where we get better. It's in those fights where we find our humanity, where we find our commonality, where we build safe, thriving spaces, where we envision our ability to fly. That's where my hope is.
Do your students come in with the kind of idealism that we want young Americans to possess? Or are you seeing evidence of the kind of cynicism that we find all around us?
I think it's a mixture of both. One is that, and that's the beauty of again, teaching history, is that I have a lot of students who are just knee-deep in social justice, that they want this world to be better. But they also see how it feels like everything is about the powerful. It's about the wealthy. And that there's no space to create that. And then we began teaching each other. And so, for instance, when I taught at the University of Missouri, I had these group research projects where I told them that three foundations had put $250 million on the table. And these students were to write a proposal to transform one of the troubled school districts in the United States. Because we know how education is foundational to the quality of life. We get education right, the rest of it really begins to work itself out in so many ways. And at first, and the districts I'm giving them are the districts that are in trouble. And at first, they look like, oh, there's just no way. This is too big. This is, oh, my God. And then they get to work. And wow. Because I'm like, transformation is not just wiring the school for the internet or putting in a few extra counselors. This is transformative. How do you transform? And giving them that space to engage, to question, to interrogate, to look at what has worked in the past, what hasn't worked, and why, to figure out policies and maneuvering around these barriers to full human rights and engagement, my students walk out empowered.
I can't think of a better lesson. Right?
Yeah.
To send those students out back out into the world.
Yes.
That sense that you can
yes.
change.
Yes.
We're asking all of our guests in the series, Carol, to choose a song that gives them what? A sense of hope that mm-hmm. speaks to them in some ways. Mm-hmm. You've chosen Stand by Sly and the Family Stone. Tell me why.
I remember that song growing up. And I remember that it was, and it still means for me, that people can stand for what they truly believe and they can fight for a better world. And it's an empowering song. It is absolutely empowering.
In a way that even, I mean, that song came out probably, what, in the 60s or 70s?
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Okay, so that song has a lot of history on it. I mean,
yes.
does it speak to you today in a moment that might feel really different from what those songwriters were writing about 40, 50 years ago?
Actually, it feels like it resonates today. When I see people standing on corners with the signs saying, you know, vote, like your life depends on it. When I see Dr. Christine Ford, who sees it as her civic duty to tell the tale about what happened to her at a house in Maryland during the Kavanaugh hearings, when that was incredible strength, when women are explaining to Senator Jeff Flake that they have been sexually assaulted and that you cannot ignore the kind of trauma and pain that that means. When folks are fighting to get police to be accountable for gunning down unarmed Black people, we are in that moment where people are standing up for a better world.
Carol, yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Things to go through if you are going anywhere. Stand for the things you know all right. It's the truth that the truth makes them so alive.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.